Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, I have a very special guest, Alicia Kaufman. Alicia did a PhD in sociology, and she has been a prolific writer, having written over 28 books. Alicia has a multicultural background. She was born in Argentina. She has European parents, and she has Spanish children. And she says this makes her very curious about the world around her. She's an analytic network trained coach, and her interests range from leadership to organizational culture, and in particular to women. Alicia, women's leadership. You're a leading woman in the field. It's very nice to have you on Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
Well, wonderful. I'm in the mountains. It's a sunny day, and I'm happy to be able to share with you some of the things I did these recent years.
And you're in the mountains outside Madrid, is that correct?
Well, it's very near from Madrid, 50 kilometers, but you know, you are trees, few people, so it's just wonderful.
Good. Sounds lovely. So you've had a wide-ranging career. You've done so many interesting things. I've known you for many, many years through the ISPSO, the International Society for Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations. We have a shared interest in psychoanalysis and leadership. Where would you like to begin with sharing some of your journey?
Well, maybe we can begin with the women leadership studies I made because, it is an interesting trip, and I detected many ideas which go against the stereotypes and allow to make changes for women in a deeper level. Do you want to begin with maybe my first research?
Yes, tell us about your challenging stereotypes.
Well, the first research, which was published in English, is this Woman in Management and Life Cycle. And I was a director at the Centro de Investigaciones Sociológicas, which is the biggest research center in Spain, but I think in Europe. They have it depends on presidency, so there's quite an amount of money there to make research. And I was invited to make a research on women leaders in 2004. There was very little written then. And so at that time, I made a first qualitative study, and I took women from 30 to 65, and then from 30 to 45, 45 to 60. And I compared how they felt, what they did. I also took a group of men to have a basis for a quantitative study. And there I found many interesting things, in the sense that when we talk about women and make generalizations, that is not at all correct, because there are many, many, many differences. And one of the many differences is the age difference. So I took the life cycle theories of Freud, Jung, mainly Katz de Vries, and I saw that the situation at the workplace is completely different, because the younger ones, they are eager, they want to compete, they have much pressure, there is all this beauty thing, and that hinders them in a certain way to advance, because they are more looked at how they look like. Whereas the elderly ones, they really can show what they know and what they want to do, and so they can advance more. At 30 years, women have to decide if they want to be mothers or not, or if they just want to develop their professional part. And this choice, men don't have to do this choice. And then when they are between 40 and 50, they have to conciliate work and family, and they are mainly devoted to others, and the possibility to advance depends on the negotiations they have with their couple, if they have a cooperation or if they are on their own. And later on, there is a whole, to make a balance between personal life and work life, and there women decide if they want, women and men decide if they want continue advancing or if they just want to shift. So this was the basis, the question of the life cycle, and we have to take it in account to make our strategy if we really want to devote mainly to work, if we want to make a balance, or if we decide not to have children.
That's very interesting, Elisa, because like you say, so many times there's a generalization of women versus men, but not the intersectional kind of idea of women from different cultures, from different generations, from different age group. And this is what you've been exploring, isn't it?
Yes, exactly that. And then also one of the important things in this study and in other studies, and that is why I made the latest books on women power and money, is which are their priorities and if they take up or not their authority. And on the second study, which was a quantitative study, and it was there was a sample of 500 persons, there one of the main questions is, what did your parents tell you at home? Which were the family mandates? And this was the most interesting finding, because women, mothers told their daughters to relax, to think on others. The economic part was not important, whereas the father's message was very important. You have to work hard. You have to be a perfect person. You have to earn your money. And so there was a big pressure on the father's part. And in the elderly generation, the mothers of these women didn't work. So the role model was the father. So when we say women at work, they really want to please their boss, it's not the boss they want to please, it's their father whom they want to please. So this is a key question to take in account.
Was this research done in Spain?
Yes, this research was done in Spain, but it was also published in London. One is Women in Management and Life Cycle by Palgrave Macmillan. And the other is Changing Female Identities. How, through the generations, women did shift and are still shifting a lot.
And do you think you've traveled quite a bit? Do you think that the Spanish gender culture is the same or different from other places? What would you think?
Well, I think in the end, it's not so different. You know, it's not so different. Maybe in societies like the States, where family has not the same pressure than in Spain, but I think in the end, the central things, the central questions, the money, the family, the children, the relations with their siblings, is almost the same. If we take it from a psychoanalytical viewpoint, I think it's not so different.
Yeah, yeah. So in your 2015 book, Women, Money and Power, tell us a bit more about your findings and your experience there.
Well, I found that women have quite a different viewpoint on money because of what they were told when they were small. And money was not the main topic, or earning their own money was not the main question. So what I felt that women, as time goes by, they incorporate a much more strategic thinking, they learn to negotiate, and what they have difficulty to consign is the emotional part, to have a family and to have success at work. So what they feel is that they have to choose, and in reality they have to choose. Because the latest studies I made was in two big banks, but this was not an academic research, but it was a work on women and the banking business. And the bosses said the women don't want to advance at the top positions. And I said, well, we'll see. Let's explore. And the women want to advance, but they don't want to pay the price to leave aside their emotional part, the families, etc., etc. But what I found, while one of the banks, of the biggest banks in Spain, they just kicked out the women when they were pregnant or had children, the other bank, which was more religiously influenced, they rewarded women if they had more children. So women felt much more at ease, and they found very creative ways to have more time. For example, instead of having a pause of 1 hour to have a meal at midday, they made like we usually make in the States. They took a sandwich and had their meetings there, and this allowed them to leave their workplace earlier. And now, before talking with you, I was talking with a colleague, and she's working with small startups, with women, with investment funds, and there women have already a completely different outlook on money. Because they make money, they don't feel guilty because they make money, they are their own bosses, and they have, I don't know how you say it in English, it's what you are doing, they have ONGs, they have organizations which are for society. They have non-profit organizations.
Yes, yeah.
So we go from a situation 20 years ago where women didn't care nothing about money. They had the Cinderella complex. The husband had the main income and they were just by the side. To a moment where they have their own startups and they have their non-profit organizations. So in 20 years, but this is still very small. This is like a baby which is growing.
The European Union has just passed a law to say that 40% of women of boardrooms should be with women now, which is a big change. It's just gone into law, I believe.
Yeah, well, there is a big debate about this. If society should pressure that more women are in the boardrooms and the top positions. And there is another group who says, we don't need societies to give us this place, we can earn this place. I really couldn't know. I don't know. The board positions are important to take decisions about the organizations. So if we can get 50 and 50 or 40 and 60, that would be good. But I don't know if we should put all the energy on that side. I really have my doubts.
Yeah. What? Why do you have doubts? I thought you'd be pleased.
Because there are so many spaces where women can contribute greatly. And I think the main space is when you ask a man or a woman what you think is most important for you. And women say, I want to have an agreeable workspace. I don't want so much to have power, but I want to have autonomy. And I want to have an agreeable life. Whereas men are much more worried about their income and their future positions. So I think this is an emblematic. You have the image with the boardrooms. Well, it's just one space, but it's not the most important space. And not all women want to be in that space, but most of the women don't want to give up having a personal life.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. What I'm noticing in the workplace, I mean, I work in the US and in Europe and in the banking system, in car manufacturing, in the not-for-profit sectors, in the health sectors. And everywhere I go, people are saying that they've noticed a really big difference in the generations now, men and women. That the new generation entering the workforce is has very different expectations of work, and it's not so much a judgment, but just saying there's a real big adjustment people are struggling with at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. I can see it with my children, you know, because as we know, there is such an uncertainty and lack of stability and. quite a fear. You know, I've been in the last listening post in London, and you know, it was very depressing just hearing all the negative part. Because, well, the United Kingdom is no longer the number one, or the States is no longer the number one. So we have to put up with this. And I think the younger generation, they live more day by day. They have children later, but they really want to enjoy the children. The couples, men participate much more. This idea, old idea of blaming always the men, we are not in the right space. Well, you have to open your own way, you know, and I see my children, how they participate and the relation with the children. So I think the priorities in general are different. And I think the younger generations are wiser than I myself have been, you know. When I see it, my daughter had just a baby, the baby's 3 months. And I see how she devotes, she's an architect, and how she enjoys. And I look back, I say, my God, how crazy I was with my profession, you know, and how she enjoys. But on the other hand, I say, well, I also gave her the possibility, I helped her to have this space. I didn't have that space, but she does have it.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's a kind of a tension between, there's a lot more fear. Jobs are more precarious. You have less like a long-term career. So there's a big anxiety on that side that you live in a more precarious world. You can lose your job quicker. And on the other side, there's this expectation of being more autonomous, of having more decision-making, of almost demanding that in the workplace, not accepting the old top-down ways of working. And I'm kind of interested in that tension, how that plays out with this new generation. And like in you know, women in schools in many countries, they're exceeding boys these days. There are more women going to university, etc., more women becoming doctors, more women joining professions. So there is quite a big shift going on. And I don't think it's a straightforward shift.
Yes, I completely agree with you. There is a big shift going on. But I want to go back 1 minute to one of the last things you said. Their studies of women are much higher. And this is very important because one of the problems of the women 20 years ago is that their mothers had very little education. So one of the factors, because of the lack of communications with their mothers, one, because there are many, was that whereas the daughters had a higher education, the mother didn't have an education, so there was a lack of understanding. Concerning what's going on now, I think we always had uncertainty, you know. I think it's not that now there's uncertainty, we were in a certain world, no. We were in a more stable world, and you could make your career development in one company. And that gave you a certain certainty, but it was also much more boring. You didn't have to take up your authority, and there were very little challenges. The fear of precariousness is a very real thing. As you said,
yes.
I was born in Argentina. I was born in Buenos Aires. And since I was born, I lived with a very high inflation. You know, you bought a coffee today and the next day it was 100% more. Inflation mm-hmm. in Argentina
yes.
now
yeah.
is 100%. In Europe, as an average, it's 10%. So now this is happening all over because the prices of food went up very much, you know, all.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So really there is a fear of this precarious thinking and the tension, but at the same time as Latin America, I can tell you that these tensions gives you much more creativity, you know, and looking for new possibilities. Because nothing is stable.
Yes, this is something I have been saying, and it's interesting because in Europe and places I work, they often think about precariousness as just a negative. And of course it is for some people. If you live in a very precarious world, not sure of your next meal or if you're going to have a job at the end of the day, this is, it creates a lot of anxiety. But as you say, I think this, when you live in a precarious world, you have to be alive. You have to kind of, you have to be thinking, to be alive, to be adaptive. And I think there's a lot of interesting things we can learn from people who have experienced precarious living, like in Argentina, like when I visited Africa recently. We need to learn from this experience as well.
Yes, I do completely agree with you, because abundance, and sometimes regarding children, I think we do too much for them. We have to do less so that they can discover their own capabilities. We're overprotective, and then you make us just invalids. But there are two important things in this question. One, you develop imagination. And the second question, you have to be very flexible in your mind. Imagine, when I came from Argentina, nobody in Spain was saying, oh, Alicia Kaufman is here, come, we offer you a tenure in our university. No. I worked at the supermarket, which was just terrible. I was a secretary. Nobody read even newspapers. Then I sold lands at the Costa del Sol, And by chance, I met a sociologist. I was so desperate, I can tell you. And he hired me because I said, well, I have this experience in Argentina. But I started from scratch, from nothing, Simon, from nothing. I was not in a political party, so I didn't have my networks to go to the top. I didn't submit to some of the doctors, as a woman. I wasn't a very agreeable woman. I think I still am. But I didn't pay any of these prices. So during 15 years, I made exams, four exams to get to the tenure. But I'm very stubborn and I got it, which is very difficult because I'm Argentinian, I'm woman, and the top of it, I'm Jewish. Well, I had to be black. But I'm very happy because, really, it was with my work, with my thinking. As Argentina is a very psychoanalytic society. After the war, many therapists migrated to Argentina. So this mindset really and the situation of Argentina helped me a lot to advance, what you say.
Yeah. Tell me, let's just two questions. I mean, one, your story is very inspiring. And I mean, it's to be a woman, Jewish, Argentinian, starting with no network, it's very, very impressive what you've achieved. So firstly, congratulations. And, that's a very rich life you're sharing with us. Why is Argentina so... so psychoanalytic? I think there's more psychoanalysts in Argentina than any other country, as I understand. Mm-hmm. Why is it so popular?
The reason was because during the war or after the war, from Vienna, there was immigration of psychoanalysts. A part of them went to the States and the other part went to Argentina. And that's why... Many psychoanalytic organizations really grew, developed, and it's part of the culture, Not going to a therapist is like, it's like being, if you cannot read or write,
And why did they go to Argentina? Was it?
Well, Argentina, my parents migrated from Prague to Argentina. Well, my story is a bit different. My father in Prague got by chance a work at the embassy. They didn't pay him anything, but he had to learn Spanish in a month, and that opened a way to go to Argentina. Argentina was a country full of possibilities, a very young country, It was a very open country, and I think the other point important of Argentina, a very diverse country. You have Germans, you have British people, you have people from everywhere. Mm. So the society, if I compare Argentina with Spain, it's completely different. Because yes. with Franco's time, this has been a very closed society, a rejection of diversity. Whereas in Argentina, it was just the contrary. Diversity was the priority. And very important analysts come from Argentina. And when the military took over in Argentina, many of these analysts migrated to Spain, to Barcelona, to Madrid. The question underneath is why so many analysts went from Europe there, because many were Jews. Freud was Jew. He was not a practical Jew, but he studied Kabbalah. And the tree of life was also the basis of his theory. So being in Europe, being Jewish, being persecuted, looking the land of new possibilities, Argentina was one of the important places.
I mean, diversity is something you've lived with, your parents, your country of birth, your movement in Europe and in Spain, your children. How does this enrich your life, do you think? What would you say living with diversity does for a person?
I think that living with diversity opens your mind and you see possibilities where others don't see possibilities.
Yeah.
I think in brief, it's exactly that.
Yeah. And what about your drive? As psychoanalysts, we talk about drive. You've had a lot of drive. You have a strong libido. You want to achieve things. Where does that come from, do you think? Your sense of achievement, your drive to achieve things.
Well, it comes probably from many places. The most primary one is that I had a brother. I had, because he passed away with 46 years. It's already 20 years ago. This has been a big loss for me. But he was the achiever in the family. Mm-hmm. And I was the intellectual. So while he was making money, I was making books. As simple as that, you know. But this was evaluated in my family only by my father. My father told me the important thing in life is to travel and to learn. The learning was the main thing. But now I'm going more into the history of Judaism. I had to present a book the other day about Nebrija, who was the founder of the grammatics, and it seems he was Jewish. The Jews in the Middle Ages, they had the obligation to read and write, 1500, whereas Christian didn't. So the only ones who could read and write were the religious people, some of the religious people, the noble people, to say the nobility, the kings, the queens, and that, and nearly nobody else. But the Jews had the obligation to read and write and to advance intellectually. This is a priority. And I think so. Yes. The two angles where this comes from is, even without knowing it, that Judaism was always pressing this, because look at how many Nobel Prizes are Jewish and how many are non-Jewish. But we are a very little population with many Nobel Prizes. So one part is from this part, and the other part is the competitiveness which was there among my brother and myself, you know. But this, I got to realize this, when I was older, because really I got on very well with him. But he didn't follow university studies, but he was a very rich and powerful man. And I really was like crazy with my studies and my books, because now I said, my God, 28 books. I must have been crazy, you know. But the truth is also that for these exams, for the tenure, I always had to make a research. And my idea was, having the situation I have, it's most probable they won't give it to me. So I look for a subject which interests me, and which can be transformed in a book. So each one of these exams where I failed or they didn't allow me to take over, this was transformed in three or four books. So this is a little secret I share with you and with the persons who are listening.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's interesting with competition in psychoanalysis. Lacan talks about putting your symptom to work, and sometimes we think about competition as envious and as a negative force, but when you can put it to work and it can produce 28 books, that's a nice thing to do, isn't it?
Well, but I think you also have a competition with oneself. I admire very much your work because you also have a trajectory which has not been at all easy, and you are where you are. So I want to say publicly that I really admire you very much because of your resilience and your hard work. But there is a point which I saw in my researches, which is little talked about, is the relations among brothers and sisters. It's hardly talked about because there's love, collaboration, but when you scratch a little bit underneath, there is a lot of other things, you know.
Yes.
And these are also one of the taboos which are not talked about. And I think it's important to be conscious about them. Not to erase them, but to know, well, that's there, so you can choose. Do you want to compete or you want to cooperate? And this has to do very much with the child rearing. With my two children, I always try to be very equanimous, that they don't feel a difference.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, we read a lot about, Klein talked a lot about the breast and the mother, and Freud was about the father and the Oedipal, and the sibling piece is demoted. And you're right, when I'm coaching people, I ask them to tell me their family story, and so often sibling rivalry or inspiration or competition or something happened within a sibling relationship, which is so, so important.
No, and then as we know in our field, what happens with the siblings, you repeat that with the colleagues at work. When you are aware of this, then you have the possibility to differentiate. This has been my family story, but I can choose something different for my workplace story. So,
yes.
But if you are not conscious, you repeat and you repeat and you repeat. And so I think the sibling question is very important to put it on the table. And if you but you say, well, I have envy. I felt my brother was the preferred one. Well, and so what? But you can admit it and you can change it then.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, so much of this repressed gets repeated. It kind of arises. And like you say, in workplace teams, we see people just repeating almost directly patterns of their childhood. And the other thing I see repeated when I was a family therapist was cross-generational patterns. I was always amazed if you did a family tree, how you could see cross-generational patterns being repeated if people are not made aware of it, the same patterns in different generations of the family.
Yes, that is fascinating. Lately, I have taken a course and read many books about biopsychodecodification, transgeneration decodification. And you see not the grandparents, later still, and how in this generational tree there are things you still repeat.
Yes, yeah, it's amazing. I was always shocked by what a family tree would show us, and the family would also be, wow, that kind of awareness. And often it's unconsciously they know it, but to make it conscious is really important.
Well,
Alicia, we're coming to the end of the podcast. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions before we finish, if that's okay. So I ask guests what from their life's work and their life they can tell us about what it means to live a good life and what it means to create a good society. Do you have any thoughts on what it means to live a good life? You seem to have lived a good one.
Well, I think the first thing is to be in peace with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And to be in peace in yourself You must have values, you know, you must have how you say in Spanish, it's brújula, when you have something that guides your life.
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
To be in peace, you need to have values and to be coherent with that values, because if not, I think you are completely lost. And I think this is one of the problems now. It's not only uncertainty and fear and precariousness, but I see that many people don't have values. You know, this consumer hyperspeed society just destroyed all this. And then you are lost. You cannot have a good life, nor contribute to have a better society. And I think it's...
That's very worrying.
And you insist much on that. And I think it's a fundamental point, you know. Mm-hmm. It's the basis for all the rest of the personality structure.
Yes.
And the social structure. If we lose that, I think we have nothing, even if we have much money.
I think that's very true. And to create a good society, a better society?
I think we can make it little by little with the person we have beside, the people we work with. I don't think you have to be in big organizations. You could change a society if you would have good leaders, you know, but we don't have leaders. There's too much corruption. And there's too much lies going on, you know. So if you don't have this stability, which is not only the economic stability, you cannot rely on others. And for me, having a word, for example, people know if Alicia Kaufman says, I will do this, whatever happens, I will do it, you know.
Yes.
And I think we need to be with people where you can rely. You can rely on the work. You can relax, you can say, well, yes, I can rely on this person. I can be myself, you know. I don't have to use masks. At times they tell me, oh, you are so direct. Well, yes, I took off the mask, you know. There are people that like me and people that hate me. Well, that's it.
That's it. Alicia, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom. And it's I wish you a lot more writings and energy to continue your great work.
Yeah, I need the energy. Well, and thank you so much for inviting me. I really was longing for this moment, so it finally happened. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alicia. Go well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.